Here I am. Good morning, everybody. Listen, I'm experiencing a little of my own personal global warming, about 102 degrees of temperature right now. Nevertheless, this is a very important program, and I'm going to ignore some of the angry fast blasts coming at me. Actually, we're going to address them, but I want you to know you're not listening to just anybody. Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel works on the National Climate Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS. She's leading UCS's climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Prior to joining UCS, she was on the faculty of the University of Arizona Department of Hydrology and Water Resources with a joint appointment in the Geosciences Department. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry. That's a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and here where I live in the desert southwest. She's also worked as a hydrologist with the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection, working with communities to protect groundwater sources. She knows what she's talking about, and in a moment, we're going to look ahead a little bit for you into the worst case scenario, and it's not that far into the future, so stay right where you are. Doctor, let's say that we ignore all or most and that any of the renewable stuff remains at the margin and we arrive at this worst case scenario, this tipping point when the big releases in the north and everything else that's going to happen actually begins to happen. What kind of world are we going to be living in?
Okay, here it goes. We have to realize that when we look at these simulations, these calculations about what could happen, there's a range of where we could cross some of these thresholds where we think we would have crossed the point where we would have irreversible change. And one of those is the large ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet of down south. And what some of the simulations suggest that if we had sustained global average temperature warming, between 2 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit above today's global average temperature, that would initiate irreversible melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And we could do what we did like we did in the past. We had the Greenland ice sheet melting and the West Antarctic ice sheet melting that raised sea level. And the amount that the sea level would rise, we could cross that threshold before it would take the full time for the ice sheet to melt, a significant amount to raise sea level on the order of 23 feet.
23 feet.
It's a combination of the perimeters of the Greenland ice sheet. There'll be this root core that will stay there for a long time in the center, but there's a lot of ice around the edges that would melt back a significant amount. And then the West Antarctic ice sheet, a lot of that is ice shelves that would be floated off and big chunks of ice that would directly contribute. As soon as you dislodge it from land, melt it, have it run off as meltwater, and go into the ocean, you directly raise sea level. And that type of sea level rise is something that would be significant for some of the major cities, including New York City, the Bay Area of San Francisco. We would have Bangladesh, the small islands that are sprinkled throughout our ocean areas that would be completely inundated by some of this type of change. And
okay, let's look
that
at it.
Would 20... be something we'd have to adapt to if we crossed that threshold. And to give an idea of how close we are to the low end of that estimate is that right now we know that we've stored so much heat in the ocean that's excess that would give heat back to the atmosphere and warm up our global average atmospheric temperature at the surface another degree Fahrenheit. So we're already halfway to the low end of that simulation. So that's it's kind of as if the scientists know that we're approaching, as if we're in a car driving towards a cliff edge, but it's a foggy night because we're not sure how fast that cliff edge is going to approach because it depends on the choices we, you and I, and all the citizens of this planet, what we make. How fast is that cliff edge going to approach? But they know that it's out there and that if we keep driving the car, then we risk driving over the cliff edge. And the problem is we just don't know how fast. And we know that we could put on the brakes and stop it and just not drive over that cliff edge. It's just we know that the low-end estimate of where we think the edge of that cliff edge is rapidly approaching. And we hope that it's the better estimate, that it's much, much higher temperature before we cross that threshold. But we're not sure. We know from the past that when carbon dioxide was not even as high as today, 130,000 years ago, sea level rose much higher than today because significant melting of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet. And so we know that the Earth is capable of doing this. It responds very rapidly when carbon dioxide is at a high temperature. It just takes centuries, and in our time scale, that seems like a long time. But we could cross that temperature. For example, the risk of crossing this threshold is some of the estimates the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has for the end of this century. So we could cross that if it was the low-end estimate of when we would cross that point where we would initiate long-term melting of significant portions of the Greenland ice sheet and contribution from the West Antarctic ice sheet.
What would New York City look like with a 23-foot change?
The lower Manhattan area, would a lot of that would be compromised. Maybe some people have seen some of the simulations in the movie, which Al Gore, in Inconvenient Truth, had these simulations. And that's taking, 20-foot sea elevation and just running that over Manhattan. It would take, now mind you, and it was said in the movie in a voiceover that it would take centuries for this to happen. It's not going to happen overnight. But that would show you that you would have parts of lower Manhattan that would be flooded. Parts of the Potomac running into D.C. would be flooded. But more importantly, the worst cases of flooding would happen in Louisiana, the huge portions of the area around New Orleans and to the left and right of that area. You lose significant parts of southern Louisiana and Florida. All the Florida Keys would be inundated. The big portions of southern Florida with that type of sea level rise.
Mm-hmm.
Not the entire continent. We'd have to move inland. It's just we have, and this has happened in the past. It's just that we didn't have a lot of people and a lot of high-dollar real estate sitting in the way of sea level rise.
That's right. All right. There are those who are sending me messages, and indeed, we're seeing Mars is warming. Other planets are warming as well, and people are suggesting that that's the cause of warming here on Earth, that that all of the planets appear to be warming. Certainly Mars is. Do you have any comments on that?
Sure. There's a very easy way we can check whether it's external, the sun, driving this change. And we have several ways of checking this. First of all, we have measurements of the sun's energy on the ground over the past century. And we see that relative to the other climate drivers, it hasn't changed too much. It's wiggled around, but it's not that much of a change compared to longer time in the past where it was the king. It drove everything. And so we have that. The other aspect is that if you have sunlight coming in, and if it were getting warmer, say, from the sun, say, you know, we had problems with our sensors on the ground, and we have a lot of measurements in the stratosphere and the lower part of the, that's the upper part of the atmosphere, and mm-hmm. we have lower part of the atmosphere where all the weather occurs, that's called the troposphere, and the entire atmosphere would warm up from this warming from the external warmth of the sun coming into our atmosphere, warming it up. What we see is because we have heat-trapping gases that are trapping the longer-wave radiation of heat, that the planet warms up, it comes back as long-wave radiation, and these heat-trapping gases are transparent to the high-energy sunlight coming in. It goes through. The heat warms up the Earth, sends it back as longer-wave radiation, and that's when these heat-trapping gases trap the heat. What we see is that the stratosphere is cooling because that heat that normally would go back out and warm both the troposphere, where the weather occurs, and then up further up in the atmosphere, that is no longer, it's not happening as much because it's trapping so much heat. So we have a cooler stratosphere than it would be if we weren't trapping so much heat. And so that's how we know that it's not coming from the sun. And you would see on Mars and these other planets, they have different types of atmospheric concentrations and so on. And so we know that it's not the sun that is driving most of the recent changes that we've seen. It's mostly driven by heat-trapping gases and some of our pollutants And whenever we have volcanic explosions that temporarily cool the Earth for a couple years, and then it bounces back once those little particulate matters are washed out of our atmosphere.
Why is there, maybe you can answer this, I'm sure you run into it all the time, but there is so much anger out there when what you're suggesting is presented to people. And I think it has to do with guilt, perhaps, because of the lifestyle we lead. I'm not sure, but there's a lot of anger.
That's right. I think that, for example, I don't want to change my ways. I want to be able to live the way I've been living. I just would hope that we could implement the technologies that are necessary to put us on the right path towards seed productions. Since I know that they already exist, I have hope. It's just where I lose hope sometimes is when I see that we don't have the political will to make full use of them. And I know that climate change sometimes can seem overwhelming, but for me, I have hope because if we weren't part of the problem, then we would only have nature driving this, and our only choice would be to be adapting.
Right.
And what gives me hope is because we're driving the climate so much, and we've had such dramatic change, we're on the beginning part of this rising curve that I know can get much, much hotter. I know that if we stop it now, then we have a chance of changing this. And in my mind, it's irresponsible to sadder our children with this problem. So if we turn it around and we have the chance to turn it around, I understand that people may think that it's you have to change your behavior. The reality is that we as individual consumers have not as many choices as I would like out there. If we were to flip on the light switch and have it be a smart sensor switch that knows that when I walk in the room, it turns on, and when I walk out, it automatically turns off, I don't even have to change my behavior. This turning on and off the light switch, you know, sometimes I'm forgetful or whatever, if with an automatic sensor, it does the work for you. If we have more energy efficient appliances that engineers can design, then it gives us as consumers more choices. If we have cars that are sporty, are attractive, can carry the number of people that we have for our personal, if we have, you know, a lot of people we cart around, that we want a larger car that can still get further down the road on a gallon of whatever fuel that we have of the future that would be perhaps a renewable fuel, then we're not changing our lifestyle. It's just we have many more choices when we go out there to purchase our goods. Because right now, I would be angry too if I hear these potential changes happening, and yet I don't have many ways as an individual. We cannot turn around as individuals because we only have what consumer energy, consumer choices that we have out there are limited because we have not implemented all the solutions that are out there. And other countries are starting to take initiative, and our country are starting to have business leaders that are saying, wow, I need to change my ways, and I'm investing money to reduce my heat-trapping gases, and then they're reaping a lot of cost savings and making their businesses run more efficiently because, in fact, we're so wealthy as a nation that we don't even notice how much we're wasting spending money on energy, on the gas prices, and our electricity bills to run our businesses. We can afford it. And so we don't even realize that there's more energy efficient ways. And personally, I'd rather have that money in my pocket and spend it on other things.
All right. Some people believe that science could pull a rabbit out of the hat. There's some idea for reflective mirrors in the stratosphere that we could put up these mirrors and reflect the sun's energy, therefore cooling the Earth, not letting as much sun hit the Earth. Is there anything like that out there?
That's right. Many people are trying to think of ways, how can we engineer our way out of this and still maybe pump out our heat-trapping gases?
Right.
So it would be a good idea if sunlight was the only concern. The fact that one of the major heat-trapping gases, perhaps the biggest culprit, is carbon dioxide because it lingers in the atmosphere so long and it's the major contributor. It is something that interacts with the ocean and becomes absorbed as a gas in the ocean, and there's a couple reactions that go on, chemical reactions, that make it change into a form that it's available for marine shell-forming organisms at the base of the food chain, those floating plankton and those little organisms that form their shell material out of this carbon that's dissolved in the ocean. And right now the ocean is very basic. What we've done is we've changed it and made it slightly more acidic, so the pH has changed about 0.01 unit over the recent time frame because of our excess of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So basically, we're acidifying the ocean. So if you had these reflectors stopping the sunlight, you might be able to cool the temperature, but we would keep acidifying the ocean if we kept pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And if you acidify the ocean to a certain point where these shells cannot no longer form their shells, then you really have ocean chaos because you have eroded the base of the food chain. And then we have the concomitant or worsening effect of, because we are also overfishing the top part and the predators. Maybe you heard about the sharks recently. We're losing some of our top predators, and that's cascading effects down the food chain. Mm-hmm. So this type of stress on the oceans is something that has oceanographers and marine biologists very alarmed, because that type of fix wouldn't solve the ocean problem. And we really wouldn't want to acidify the ocean to a point where the base of the food chain couldn't form their shells.
Speaking of the ocean, of course, we went through Katrina. That's fresh in everybody's mind. The ocean gets warmer, and I understand what drives these hurricanes and typhoons. I spent last year in Manila in the Philippines, and boy, while Florida got off easy in the whole U.S. got off easy in terms of hurricanes, typhoon after typhoon after typhoon slammed into us in the Philippines where I was, and it was a rough, rough year for typhoons. Now, what's going to happen if we get to this tipping point with regard to storms? They're going to get larger, aren't they?
Well, what we see is that there is evidence that over the past, since we've had satellites, and you bring up a very good point, I think in the U.S. media did not cover as much those typhoons. They might have been on
the
back page, right?
That's right.
Even though we had an average year in the Atlantic for hurricanes, where you are, it's the same type of storm, they're just called a different name, typhoons. The oceans, you know, worldwide, we have about the same number that happen, okay, each year. It's about 90 plus or minus 10 that happen worldwide each year. And the disturbing trend is that we're seeing that over the last 30 years that we've seen an increasing in the intensity of those mm-hmm. storms. So the number hasn't really shifted. It's just the intensity. So we have more category, like a tropical storm might now be a typhoon or a hurricane. And so this is a double whammy for coastal residents, because you have higher sea levels, and now your storm surges are getting bigger, and you may have increasing intensity of these storms. What we've seen in the Atlantic, if you just look at hurricane landfall, you'll see just kind of a random pattern. Luckily, in the Atlantic Ocean, we have only, say, 12% of the world's storms occur in the Atlantic. And then only a tiny fraction of those really make landfall. So we have the statistics on our side. It's just, unfortunately, when it's a big storm like we've experienced that have hit Florida or have hit the Gulf Coast, One big storm can have devastating consequences.
Well, I'll say.
That's something to keep an eye for.
What I saw in the Pacific last year was absolutely amazing, and there was a little bit of it the prior year in the Atlantic, and that was what was one day a tropical storm or a tropical depression. You'd take a good night's sleep, get up the next day, and it would have gone from a tropical depression to a Category 4. And then the next day, it was Category 5. Now, I saw some pretty strange things. We all did in the Atlantic the prior year, but last year in the Pacific, trust me, there were, I can't tell you how many storms went from tropical storm to Category 4 and then 5 that fast. And I wonder if that's what we're looking at times a few if we get to that tipping point. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. It is, and I hope you're listening carefully. Dr. Brenda Eckersall is my guest, and she's talking about global warming, what it's going to mean to us. And in a moment, perhaps we'll talk a little about the human health consequences, possible consequences, perhaps emerging diseases, things that will begin to appear where they have not before, little things, just the little things that we might might start seeing very soon if this continues. We'll be right back. Doctor, in recent years, there have been a lot of emerging diseases that have kind of surprised people. If the Earth continues to warm, is that going to be a problem that's going to be exacerbated?
What we do see is that with warming, we're starting to see a change in how the diseases are spreading in different areas. For example, we see that certain mosquitoes or ticks that carry certain aspects of them that are harmful to humans, they extend their range. And this includes, for example, agricultural pests. For example, if you live in a northern climate, your winters, having that frost, that frozen temperature in the winter, really keeps some pests and some in check. But if you start having milder winters and you start having perhaps rodents that might carry the hentavirus, and you have perhaps some other disease vectors, these carriers of these diseases, lasting through that winter and then coming back as pests that plague a farmer, or the hentavirus, people with the mouse cleaning up in their barn or whatever, or anywhere. That there was a outbreak of hentavirus in the Southwest that was linked to milder winter temperatures and so on. And when they're starting to see in other parts of the world that that is breaking out more. Malaria is changing its distribution pattern in parts of Africa and other parts of the world. We're starting to see that the aspects of smog formation, which when you have higher summer temperatures and you have the volatiles that are coming out of the tailpipes of your cars, it's this combination that creates this smog, and that creates a lot of stress on people who have cardiopulmonary disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot more, we've incredible increase in the incidence of asthma attacks, driving people to the hospital during these hot summer days. You see this, it's one of the leading reasons perhaps children may be going to the children's hospital, say in the Oakland area, or other urban areas of our nation. We see that. And so these type of stresses, additional stresses, and one of the more just common irritants that we all are noticing is that the seasons, we have season creep. And so that means that the spring may be coming earlier, and we have these things coming into bloom. We have a longer spring. There's more pollen loading. And so the common allergies that people suffer from and the amount of pollen that is brought into our environments are becoming more and more of a problem that is perhaps just a minor irritant, but to some it's really, you know, a major,
very major
longer season. Yes, it really compromises your energy and everything. It's not life-threatening, but it's just one of those, as you say, some of these health aspects that compromise our lives a little bit.
It sure did shock me how quickly West Nile moved across the country.
Yes, that's something that had really spread very fast. And what we're starting to see is that there are mosquitoes that are appearing for the first time up in Alaska and parts of Canada. And so they're moving. They're on the move. And if it's warmer, we're seeing all the species are starting to shift and move and come out earlier in the spring and unroll their leaves, start their buds, lay their eggs. The fish are migrating earlier. We see cold water fish species being replaced by warmer water species. This is affecting perhaps people who are sportsmen who like to fish, and they're seeing the change in the type of species that they're catching. And also for the commercial fisheries, they're changing. If you have your particular whole economic investment in fishing a certain type of fish that's off of your coast, and then now the species are changing, you might have to be changing all of your rigging and things like that. But it's just something that is undeniable. No matter where you look, we have seen this rapid warming over the past several decades, and the species are responding. They're trying to cope, and we also are noticing the changes in our own health, for example.
I suppose, Doctor, there's good news in this for somebody. I mean, some colder climate is going to get warmer, and that's going to please some people somewhere. So it's
that's right. We are expected to have a longer growing season. And so parts of the northern parts of the United States, Canada, parts of Northern Europe, parts of Russia, and different places are going to be able to grow crops that they weren't able to grow before.
Mm-hmm.
And we agriculture can take advantage of this with a little bit of warming. We see that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has projected that with, say, a little bit of warming, you might have increased growing seasons in parts of the world and crop productivity increasing, but dramatic declines in the tropics and subtropics. And there are many, many people who live in those parts of the world and depend on their livelihood growing some of those crops. And so that will decline. And then if you get too hot, even those of us in the more northerly latitudes, mid-latitudes and higher, our crop productivity in some areas with some crops would start suffering as well. So you kind of don't want to get too hot before things get bad all over the world.
If nothing changes, Doctor, how soon is it going to be apparently uncomfortable for a lot of people?
Well, what we see is that no matter what, we have another degree Fahrenheit of warming in the pipeline. And that, to put that in perspective, this is global average temperature. Mm-hmm. That means that that's the same amount of warming that we had happen over the last century. And this will happen over the next few decades, so it's a little faster. And when we say global average temperature, that means the oceans, the land, everything all added up.
Sure.
That's just a small change. We, who live in the northern hemisphere and on land, and if you're in the interior of the continent, you have much higher local average temperatures going up. And if you're in the Arctic, you are really, really warming up. So the polar bears and the ring seal and the people who are living up there will see dramatic changes. And we ourselves, in where the United States is located, and especially Alaska, we'll see, the Alaska residents will see more rapid warming than we will in the lower 48. And so we're parts of the world that will see a lot of change. And so when you see that type of heat, you got to up the local temperatures much more for the average temperature.
Well,
so, for example, the tri-state area.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We could get people from Alaska on here now, and they would tell you right now they're already seeing what they would describe as gigantic changes in their climate.
That's right. There are residents who live in Shishmaref, Alaska. It's a famous location now in that they used to have sea ice offshore in the winter that would protect them from coastal storms that would whip up strong waves. But they couldn't whip up waves. The wind couldn't in the winter because there was ice covering the ocean off their shores. Now, with the sea ice retreating, there are times of the year where these strong storms are coming through, and they are creating these huge waves and creating storms that are eroding their shoreline at such a pace that people are going to have to relocate, and there's talk about relocating the entire community of Shishmaref. You know, they're already at their own personal tipping point, so to say.
Okay. What can... is this a situation where people could ignore their government and the government's policies and make individual changes that would add up to something meaningful? I mean, if everybody were to use fluorescence, if everybody were to change their bulbs, and we all know they're out there and you can get them, they're still a little bit expensive compared to the average light bulb, would that be enough?
It would go a long way towards making a big difference, but it would not be enough. We want to create more choices, and so that's where we need perhaps national actions to give more choices across the board and to make it easier. But, for example, if every American household did replace just one incandescent light bulb, the Environmental Protection Agency estimates that that would reduce global warming emissions that would be equivalent to taking about 800,000 cars off the road. It would be equivalent to what those guys in that sector emit. And so that's a huge, huge impact. So if you replace two, then that starts you down on the path. For example, if we start meaningful reductions, if each of us could figure out, say, what we could cut back, say, 4% a year, then that means that you replace a light bulb 1 year, and the next year you replace another light bulb, and then you figure out ways to drive your car a little differently, or one day a week carpool, and that immediately drops a significant amount what your personal footprint is. And so it does add up. But the unfortunate thing is that when you go and buy a car, I personally would want to have a lot more choices out there when I'm choosing my next car, because that's one of the big sectors of what we emit. Because, for example, if we were to have fuel-efficient cars that can cut heat-trapping pollution by 40% in 10 years, we have that off-the-shelf technology, that would really put us well down the road towards meaningful reductions that could avoid some of the worst effects that we have already talked about today.
Why are we not doing it, Doctor?
I think we just don't have the political will to make full use of these technologies. For example, if you took all the available technologies, some of our engineers have said, okay, look at the cars out there, look at all the technologies that are available. Let's combine them together and try to make a fuel-efficient car. Mm-hmm. And it's possible. You can basically create, you can add another gear to the car and make a much more fuel-efficient car. You can have a unibody that would make the car stronger but also lighter materials. You can get a lot further down the road. One of the things, a personal solution you could do is if you kept your tires properly inflated, it's one of the easiest ways to improve mileage by up to 3%, mm-hmm. because there's friction as you're rolling down the highway that the engine has to overcome when you have an underinflated tire. So that's, again, a waste of energy. Your engine's having to overcome that friction. So if you keep your tires fully inflated, that reduces the friction, and you have nice, smooth rolling and rolling down the highways with less fuel being burnt up.
I just watched a program earlier today on wind energy, and it looks as to be at least a partially viable solution. I guess the point is that it's not as reliable as you would want it to be. But if we had wind generators scattered all over the western U.S., for example, it seems to me as though the wind's always blowing someplace or another.
That's right. I mean, that is something that we have that's free to us. I mean, how we harness it isn't quite free, but instead of sending our dollars overseas for expensive oil that we do not have in our country at the same level of what we burn every year, we're importing so much, the wind and the sun are free to us. And in fact, if you had Death Valley, we should harness some of that sun energy. We have enough. If you were to harness the energy of wind and sun in the United States, that would meet all the projected energy demands that we have over the next coming decades easily. We have so much energy that we just aren't harnessing right now. And some of the utility engineers are coming up with ways for wind energy. If you orient the wind turbines in all the different directions to capture wind, whatever direction it's blowing in a certain field, you can harness wind for longer. And then at the nighttime, when there's less wind that tends to blow at night, during the day, if you were to pump up water up a hill, and then at nighttime let it run down through pipes and have it be a hydropower, that's the way that you could have energy from wind basically 24/7, because you use the excess wind from a very windy day, pump up water uphill, the excess energy that's not being demanded during the day, and then let that water run downhill, and you generate hydropower at night. And that's a way of storing some of the excess energy generated during the day from the sun, you know, heating up the surface and wind blowing across our land. And so wind energy is something we can take more use of. Right now, it's such a tiny, tiny percentage. Just a few percent of our national energy is from wind, but many states across the nation are increasing their renewable energy standard to try to, some say, let's have 20% of our electricity when we turn on the lights come from renewable energy, whatever that may be, geothermal, wind energy, solar energy, as long as it's renewable, that every year we can harness new energy from the sun or the wind or from geothermal.
Well, you take my state as an example. Here in Nevada, about 90% of Nevada is federally owned land, and rather remote, and I don't think people would object too much to wind generators, and we get plenty of wind, or to a lot of land being covered with solar panels. And we get, I don't know how many days of sun every year, but it's a lot. And so this state could be turned into a wind generation and solar generation bonanza for the country. I just can't understand why we're not doing it.
It's amazing because it creates so many jobs here at home because we really need to have people that would maintain these wind turbines. You have to build the wind turbines and so
That's
on.
Right.
And that creates jobs here at home, and we have so much outsourcing problems as it is. And that's homegrown energy, which is really a nice thing. The other aspect is that in these more remote areas where people may not see these wind turbines and so on, or the solar panels that are generating all this energy, that creates a situation where one state can supply energy for other states that may be more densely populated and may not want to have some of this in their backyard. And so this becomes a situation where if we have distributed energy all throughout the nation, then we have many, many people are starting to, farmers are starting to say, this is my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I let people put wind turbines. I've seen, and you've seen it too, I've seen cattle grazing on land where there's a wind turbine and such a small footprint on the ground, and the cattle have really almost all the land to graze upon. It's just
right.
There's wind turbines above them. And so it's a multi-use situation for people who have a lot of land.
So it boils down to political will, really. Our government certainly has the money. Our nation has the wealth. We can do this. It's just a matter of the will.
That's right. And I think we have to move beyond the science of global warming and really unleash the engineers who can figure out the science of solving this problem and be like the Manhattan Project and figure out how are we going to figure out some of the really new, neat, fun ways of figuring out energy in the future. I just was reading an article, people are harnessing sugars to maybe create energy that we might be able to just enough energy in a carbonated beverage that could recharge our cell phones. I mean, they're coming up with all sorts of things. It's just amazing what types of smart gadgets we're going to have in the future. And we could go hiking in the desert and be able to recharge perhaps some of our aspects of what we would need just with some simple chemical fuel cells that we'd be bringing with us.
Well, the science on global warming seems settled. It really does seem almost like a settled science now. It's really happening. But it's not settled among the general public. I mean, as I look at some of the messages I'm getting on my computer, it's obvious that a lot of people, and I think, again, it has to do with this guilt factor. That's all I can figure. But an awful lot of the general public is not settled about this at all. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's several factors. One is it is sort of a strange thing, and a lot of the more scary impacts are further off. So we don't tend to plan for the future often. We like to think about the here and now. So that's a little challenging. But the other aspect is that I think the public has been given mixed messages about the science. And so we can talk about that. But if you have government scientists who aren't able to talk freely to the public about their new findings, and that the science has become very clear over the past 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
And then you have also companies, perhaps other people who are in fair and balanced reporting both sides of the science and obscuring the truth, then the public is understandably confused. And I would be too if I didn't study this.
All right, doctor. Hold it right there. When we come back, we'll find out what some of the public actually thinks about all this. And I think you'll be quite surprised. Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel is my guest. She is a scientist. She says it's happening. I believe it's happening. In a moment, you'll have your say.